Welcome to Ethnically Ambiguous, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hi!
Hi, Shireen.
This is episode 116.
This is Anna.
And I said my name. Yeah. Damn it.
Well, I said hi, Shireen.
This is Shireen.
this is Anna. This is both of us.
This is both of us. This is EA. Today, I kind of like the format of this episode because it kind of feels very like news reporty. We are going to dedicate this episode to the news that's been happening and what's happening with the Kurdish population in Syria, the U.S.'s decision to pull out their military forces over there, and what this means as far as what the Turkish government is planning. And then we call one of our correspondents, I want to call him, Robert Evans, about his experience having traveled to Rojava, this northwestern region in Syria, just this past August. So I think it's a great episode.
Yeah. So listen up. Come to Chicago Podcast Festival and see us live in 2 days, October 16th, 7 p.m. at the Hungry Brain. Tickets
two
in the
days
footnotes.
On Wednesday. If you're not there and you're able to be there, you're dead to us.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi. Hello. It's episode number 116 of Ethnically Ambiguous. I'm Shireen.
Hi, Mana. And this is a special report coming from Ethnically Ambiguous.
But it really is special because today we have a call-in correspondent, you can say.
Yeah.
Yeah. We wanted to dedicate this episode to talk about what's happening in Syria with Turkey and the U.S. and what it all means.
The Kurds.
And the Kurds.
The Kurdis.
And try to break it down as much as we can. There's just so much information, so we'll probably have to revisit it in another episode. But we thought we would at least try to touch on it as much as we can. And then we call Robert Evans from Behind the Bastards,
who recently was in Syria, and we're going to get his insight on a lot of things.
Yeah.
So that'll be the second half of the episode. We're just going to jump right into it. We're going to give a lot of insight because I don't feel like maybe a lot of people understand what's really going on with, I don't know, maybe if you guys have news alerts on your phone, or maybe you check the news Monday morning or Sunday evening, and you may have saw that Trump has decided to back the Turkish military operation that would basically go in and sweep the American-backed Kurdish forces near the border in Syria. And that area is called Rojava.
Yeah. It's like northwest Syria.
Yeah, northwest Syria. It's the one that's closest to
the Turkish border.
Yeah. It's a really big deal because it's like a huge shift in the United States military policy in Syria. Trump has decided to endorse Erdogan and his Turkish military operation that would take out the American-backed Kurdish forces that are on the border in Syria. And to give you some background, the Kurdish people, they're an Iranian ethnic group which are native to Western Asia. Geographically, the mountainous area is known as Kurdistan, which includes southeastern Turkey, northwestern Iran, northern Iraq, and northern Syria. And there's also like more enclaves of Kurds, but they're basically like a minority ethnic group that don't have their own country.
Yeah. Turkey considers the Kurdish forces that are in northern Syria to be a terrorist or like insurgency. The Turkish government has always wanted to end the American support for this group. The Kurdish fighters, however, they're part of the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, and they have been the United States' most reliable partner in fighting the Islamic State, aka ISIS, in this strategic corner of northern Syria. And this corner of northern Syria, because it's on the border of Turkey, has always been very highly, not militarized, but also tense. It's a very tense area, but it's been able to be kept under control because of the U.S. forces being there to kind of watch over and kind of calm any tensions. So with this pulling out of these forces, it kind of invites a new level of conflict.
Yeah, and so Trump's decision, it goes against recommendations from, you know, top Pentagon and State Department officials who they have sought to keep the small troop presence in southeast Syria to continue operations against ISIS or the Islamic State and to act as a counterweight to Iran and Russia. But these officials said that Mr. Trump spoke directly with President Erdogan of Turkey on the issue on Sunday. The officials indicated that 100 to 150 U.S. military personnel deployed to the area would be pulled back in advance of any Turkish operation, but they would not be completely withdrawn from Syria.
And then just a quick little statistic here. The Kurds are the largest ethnic minority in Syria. They make up between 7 and 10% of the Syrian population as of 2011. And this is between 1.6 and 2.5 million people. So even though we're calling them an ethnic minority, it's a big amount of people. It's a it's a very notable amount of the region over there are Kurds. And so on Monday, witnesses in Syria, they reported that they saw the U.S. forces withdrawing from two positions in northeastern Syria, both from the observation ports in Tel Abyad and El Isan. I feel like I should be able to pronounce these words, but I can't figure them out when they're spelled in English letters.
Ayn Issa.
Ayn Issa.
I mean, who knows? Or so, maybe it's Ayn Issa because it's the E, but I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Maybe. Regardless, witnesses on Monday of last week saw the U.S. forces withdrawing from these positions in northeastern Syria. So the White House said in a statement released last week in Washington, Turkey will soon be moving forward with its long-planned operation into northern Syria. The United States Armed Forces will not support or be involved in the operation. And U.S. forces, having defeated the ISIS capital, quote, caliphate, will no longer be in the immediate area. So they're basically saying, like, because ISIS is not a direct threat anymore because they defeated the caliphate, they're like, this is reason we should just pull out and we're all, our job is done here, essentially. When really, like, they've been the ones keeping the peace for a long time.
And it's pretty complicated. We'll get to why it's so complicated with ISIS, Islamic State, in a little bit later. But it's unclear how extensive the Turkish operation would be or whether Turkish forces would clash with the American-backed Kurds. Clearly, they won't. It's just like a development that could jeopardize the counterterrorism gains achieved by the American military in the fight against ISIS. And last December, Trump called for a complete United States withdrawal from Syria, but ultimately reversed this plan after backlash from the Pentagon, diplomatic and intelligence officials, as well as important allies in Europe and the Middle East, because they were like, don't fucking do it.
Yeah. Soner Kagapte, he is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the author of Erdogan's Empire, Turkey and the Politics of the Middle East. He said in a telephone interview that a Turkish incursion uncontested by the U.S. would allow Turkey to cut another swath into the Kurdish-controlled territory in Syria, and this would give Erdogan a ready place to send hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees and prove yet again his influence with Mr. Trump on Syrian policy. So I think the story behind them wanting this territory is that they want to give thousands of refugees a place to be, but it's kind of displacing more people in the process. And so he went on to say this is a quite significant development. Many experts about Syria, they criticized the White House decision and they cautioned that an American abandonment of its Kurdish allies could widen the 8-year Syrian conflict and prompt the Kurds to ally with the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad to combat this much larger and more technologically advanced Kurdish army.
And
advanced Turkish army. I misspoke.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about that if the Kurdish allies would actually go more towards the Syrian government and Bashar al-Assad with Robert. But you'll hear his thoughts on that later. According to Representative Ruben Gallego, an Arizona Democrat and former Marine who served in the Iraq War, he tweeted, allowing Turkey to move into the northern Syria is one of the most destabilizing moves we can do in the Middle East. The Kurds will never trust America again. They will look for new alliances or independence to protect themselves, which is true. Like, they've been a minority ethnic group their whole life where they've basically have, I don't know what to compare them to in our own country, but like they are constantly, there's racism against them. They're ethnically cleansed often and they have nowhere to go. So they tend to find these little enclaves to take care of themselves. And it's kind of a situation where they tend to shut people out because they don't trust anyone. And that's kind of what we're creating more distrust with them by doing this. An announcement by the White House came as a shock to the SDF, and Kurdish officials said on the day after the statement came out. In their own statement, the SDF said that it had fulfilled its obligations in the efforts to reduce tensions with the Turks, but the United States had not. And the statement warned that a Turkish incursion could endanger the progress made to establish security in the wake of a battle against Islamic State. It also called on Kurdish forces to defend our homeland from the Turkish aggression.
Yeah, a good point to bring up that there's going to be distrust with America because American forces helping the Kurds was a big step in the Syrian conflict because American support was so limited when the Syrian war even started. And I talked to my mom about this extensively, and I think siding with the government is a huge betrayal. And it's just, it's a lose-lose because you want to survive. And if you're not going to get help from the U.S., for example, you're going to turn to more extreme people. That's how the rebellion started, getting weapons from ISIS. And it just becomes more convoluted because you don't know whose side is worth fighting on because you don't know who's going to help you. So it's just, it becomes so morally questionable. Regardless, we're going to touch on that more when we talk to Robert, but since early August, the American and Turkish militaries have been working together on a series of confidence-building measures, including joint reconnaissance flights and ground patrols in a 75-mile-long strip of that 300-mile border area. And American-backed Kurdish forces have pulled back several miles and destroyed fortifications in the area since then.
Mm-hmm. And the pace of these operations, according to Erdogan, the president of Turkey, have not been fast enough. And last week, he began indicating that he planned to launch an incursion across the border. He did the same thing over the summer, prompting like a bunch of American diplomatic activity because of the military confidence building measures. Like they started to panic. But Defense Secretary Mark T. Esper and General Mark Milley, who's the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, both called their Turkish counterparts last week to try and reduce tensions. But unresolved threats from Turkey apparently resulted in the decision by Mr. Trump on Sunday.
The American officials that were contacted late on Sunday would not say how far back from the Turkish border American troops would redeploy or whether this signals the beginning of a larger overall withdrawal of 1,000 American troops now in northeast Syria, conducting and supporting counterterrorism operations. Those troops rely on their partnership with the SDF, which has a total of 60,000 total fighters, including both Kurdish and Arab militias. Mm. One official who spoke on condition of remaining anonymous, he described a fluid military situation and said that American forces were pulling back from northeast Syria to, quote, get out of the way, which is unsettling, to say the least.
Yeah, and this part's where it gets icky. So officials described the military and political tension as the American military is pulled between two important allies in the civil war in Syria. Turkey is a major NATO ally, but the Kurdish SDF is what you put on your face in the sun. SDF forces have been a partner in the fight against ISIS. Now, NATO, if you don't know what that is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They're an international alliance that consists of 29 member states from North America and Europe. And it was established in 1949. They kind of are supposed to, I don't know, keep shit together. Who knows? Yeah. The treaty is supposed to keep shit together. But the official said, we are not going to support the Turks and we are not going to support the SDF. If they go to combat, we're going to stay out of it. But Turkey is NATO. They are a NATO military company.
Ally,
whatever. They're NATO. They are NATO. So if you go and kill a bunch of people, that's NATO killing a bunch of people.
Yeah.
So,
which is, it's tricky because NATO was established post-World War II. So it's like when you learn about NATO when you're in fucking high school, it's like kind of considered like the axis of good. Like these are the good guys. But now I think it's a little tricky because you have a country like Turkey in NATO kind of threatening to kill a bunch of Kurds. So you're like, where? I don't know. It's kind of just gray area.
So I'm going to give a really quick background of what happened last spring. But basically, the Kurdish forces, they helped defend the Syrian city of Kobane from ISIS. And Kobane is in the Kurdish region of Rojava in northeast Syria. The Turkish NATO army, so they're coming up against the border. And they have a bunch of overwhelming firepower and high-tech equipment that is, like, the most advanced military forces have. Like, you're not going to have, like, if you're not part of a organization, you're not just going to have, like, the most high-tech equipment, obviously, because you need money to get these things. And the commander-in-chief, Erdogan, says he wants to return Rojava to its rightful owners, who he believes are Arabs, not Kurds. Mm-hmm. So remember that, because that's ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
But last spring, Erdogan made similar declarations about the westernmost Syrian Kurdish district of Afrin. Following that, the very same Turkish NATO army, using German tanks and British helicopter gunships and backed by thousands of hardcore Islamist auxiliaries, overran that district of Afrin. According to Kurdish news agencies, the invasion led to over 100,000 Kurdish civilians being driven out of Afrin entirely, and they reported they employed rape, torture, and murder as systematic means of terror, and that reign of terror continues to this day. And Erdogan, the commander-in-chief of this NATO army, has suggested that he intends to do the same with the rest of North Syria as he did to Afrin. So that
is just terrifying.
Yeah, so guess what? Turkey is NATO. NATO is killing.
Yeah.
Is going, well, they haven't done anything yet, but that's what it leads to.
But they've done that in the past, which is which is like disturbing to say that's like how they operate, because again, you're taught that this North Atlantic Treaty Organization is the side of good, kind of similar how like when you hear the UN is the side of good, but this is, it's just not the same anymore. It's not how it was post World War II.
So this was very interesting to me, this part that I read about, because I started to like research further into NATO and Turkey and all that. And apparently the Western press, they feel obliged to play along with the charade that is like this enemy of ISIS, except there's a ton of evidence that have that show active Turkish collaboration with ISIS. And the fact is known to the region. And we talk about this a little further with Robert and how people discuss it and what they've seen. But the Turkish offenses against ISIS in Syria have largely consisted of bribing ISIS commanders to switch sides. And here's some examples of ISIS collabing with Turkey. And I'm going to put a footnote that gives a lot more evidence further. We just don't have a lot of time to go into it because it's a lot of evidence. But Turkey provides military equipment to ISIS. Turkey provided transport and logistical assistance to ISIS fighters. Turkey offers medical care to ISIS fighters, and Robert will touch a little on that later. Turkey supports ISIS financially through purchase of oil, which we'll also discuss that later. Turkey assists ISIS recruitment, and Turkey helped ISIS in Battle of Kobani, which is a whole thing. Yeah. I mean, look at the footnotes to read through the rest of that, the full breakdown of that evidence, but it's there. They're helping ISIS, so
it's just disturbing because no one's really talking about the underbelly of all of this, which is just like kind of rooted in, I don't know, just awful acts. And as recently as the week of the UN General Assembly summit in late September, senior American officials were saying that there was a consensus across the United States government, including with Trump, on ensuring the welfare of the Kurdish forces and warding off Turkey's persistent desire to attack those forces. But around the same time, Turkish officials were privately saying that they saw things very differently. They said they perceived a sharp division between Trump and other American officials, most notably generals in the U.S. Central Command, which oversees troops in the Middle East. While it was clear the generals wanted to bar Turkey from the safe zone and keep American troops there, Trump clearly wanted the troops out, they said. And in the end, he might get his way, obviously, because mm-hmm. Trump somehow has a way of just turning everything to actual crap. We're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back, breaking this down a little bit further, and then calling Robert. So stay tuned. We're back.
We were talking about the situation with Trump backing Turkey to basically take out the Kurdish forces on the Syrian northeast border.
Mm-hmm.
And this apparently all came to fruition when President Erdogan traveled to New York with the intention of talking about Syria and the Kurds with Trump in a private meeting. He attended a group dinner hosted by Trump, but the two did not have a formal meeting there. Trump did say at one event that Erdogan had become a friend of mine. And then a telephone call between the two on Sunday may have been organized as a substitute for the meeting that never took place. And I think this is kind of where Erdogan was able to get Trump to back his plans, his military plans, and
I think every
that's where it all went.
Anytime
wrong.
Trump says this person is a friend of mine or has become a good friend of mine, that should be like a billion red flags. He said that about Kim Jong-un. He said that about fucking Putin and fucking just every single person that is just, oh my God, this guy really fucking makes me mad.
Yeah.
So Kurdish civilians in northeastern Syria.
This is what's going on right now.
Oh yeah. So as of today, we're recording this on Tuesday, October 8th. So much is going to happen by the time you guys hear this, but mm-hmm. as of now, Kurdish civilians in northeastern Syria, they're planning to stage an open-ended sit-in in the areas near the border with Turkey in response to a looming Turkish military operation. This is according to local activists and journalists. They're going to be sitting in huge tents. People of all ages have already begun gathering in the towns of Ras El Ain and Tez Abyad and Kobane. And according to Arin Chekhoms, they're an activist based in Qamishli. I'd say that's an L.
I don't know.
Qamishli. They said they want to stand as human shields to prevent a Turkish advance.
Yeah. So it's looking, yeah. In my opinion, this isn't about ISIS at all, because clearly Turkey and ISIS seem to have some sort of deal. It looks like they just want to ethnically cleanse and wipe out the Kurds and return the land back to the Arabs. And they, I believe more than anything, Erdogan just wanted to show his power over Trump, that he could get Trump to listen to him and do as he say and back him. And he's like, look, guys, even Trump's on my side. Let's ethnically cleanse a bunch of Kurds and take the land back and then put the goddamn refugees there, because I don't want the refugees in my own country.
Yeah.
It's fucked up.
Hundreds are also gathering outside a UN office to call for international action. So there's a ton of activism and protest that's been spurred because of this. And it's just, at the same time, international concerns, like Britain has said that it's deeply concerned by Turkish military plans. It said Turkey's looming move to target Kurdish militias in northern Syria is concerning. A spokesperson for the Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the British government had been, quote, consistently clear with Turkey that unilateral military action must be avoided mm-hmm. because it would destabilize the region. And that should be obvious. Like, this will destabilize the region after years of trying to stabilize it and being successful. Robert was over there in Rojava in mid-August, and it's not a perfect situation, but it's definitely in the right direction. Mm-hmm. You're taking steps to progress and stability only to completely shatter any kind of hope. So it's just really messy. And at the same time, the fucking government, the Syrian government, which obviously I despise, Bashar al-Assad, Faisal Maqdad, the Syria's deputy foreign minister, he's calling on the Syrian Kurds to rejoin the government side because he says they would plunge into the abyss as they brace for this imminent Turkish attack. He said, the homeland welcomes all its sons and Damascus will solve all Syrian problems in a positive way away from violence. He was quoted as saying that in a pro-government newspaper, El Watan. And he said, we advise those who have gone astray to return to the nation because the nation is their final destiny. And he vowed to, quote, defend all Syrian territory. And his comments were the first Syrian government reaction since Trump's announcement from withdrawing U.S. troops from the northern region. Because this person's from the government, everything he says is not very trustworthy, I think, especially because defending all Syrian territory and saying, like, we welcome all the sons into Damascus and we're going to protect all Syrians just completely goes against the fact that they've been killing Syrians every year for the past, like, 8 years because of the Syrian war. So there's just no good guy here. And that's what makes me upset, is because, and I asked Robert this later, it's just like, I don't see actual solution right now.
I don't know if there is a solution, especially when Erdogan is in power, because he's not a good person. He's probably the worst thing to happen to Turkey in a very long time.
Yeah.
He brought religion to a secular state, which is like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because I had a friend from Turkey, like born and raised in Turkey, staying with me over the weekend while this was kind of falling apart. And he genuinely said, like, Erdogan ruined Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
He's brought in this kind of religious regime style type of running a force of running a country.
Yeah.
And it's a part of the destabilization of the Middle East.
Yeah.
So It feels like we just got these big ass heads bobbling around. I don't know. I also don't know. And, you know, we're going to take a quick commercial break and then we're going to talk to Robert Evans and we're going to hear more about what it's like from the Kurdish minority. And there's more than just Kurd minorities, which Robert will break down for us. Just their world and what it's like and what Robert experienced. Because I also think their experiences are so much more important than like how fucking Turkey feels, you know? It's like these are real people who've created a world for themselves because they had nowhere else to go.
And that's all being threatened to not exist anymore.
That's all being threatened because Turkey can't take responsibility for how evil they are, really, is, and how much they just want to get. And that's the problem is we as people have been trying to, and I say we because I'm Iranian, and Iranians haven't necessarily been good to Kurds either. Like, you know, and this is something Robert says, a quote that the Kurds always say, which is they're only allies, basically the mountain. Their only friend is the mountain. And it's very, it really rung true to me because when I go to Iran, the Kurds are always the people that work for your family. Mm-hmm. So that's how you know them. You know, they're people who they're the people who clean your house. They're the people who do your laundry. They're people that take care of your land. And that's just who they are seen as. And I, for a very long time growing up, never had a, you know, I was just raised as like, I mean, I hate to say like, I was like the bourgeois and they were like the proles. Like we were treated, like I treated them how I saw them as like people who work for our family. And there's something so dark to me about that. Like I literally thought of them as mountain people.
Well, because
like, those are the people that come from the mountain and work for our families because they're just poor. And it took a long time in my life to really realize that like, oh no, this is an ethnic minority that is clearly being discriminated against. We are racist towards them, even though their blood is for the most part the same as ours. Yeah. Like we're all Middle Eastern, you know, like we're all from the mountain. The whole fucking region is a giant mountain. And I actually really quickly before we take a break, I want to tell this story where a cousin of mine lives out deep in the countryside in Iran. And there's reasons why he moved out of there. Women trouble. But anyway, that's another story. But he lives alone. His sons live on the property and stuff like further away because he owns a bunch of land. And he has a Kurdish family that works for him and runs the land. Like they do, the wife does all the cooking. The son takes care of the animals. The husband takes care of the land. And then they have a little daughter who's about, when I was interacting with her, she was about 11 or 12, which really bums me out. What I'm about to tell you next. She has helped the mom with the cooking and the cleaning, and I would talk to her a little, and she could speak a little Farsi, but you can tell like it wasn't the most. This is also in West Azerbaijan, which is an Azeri region. So we speak like a different dialect of Turkish. We speak like an Azeri Turk, but me and her were able to communicate through Farsi because it's not their regional or whatever. It's not their language, whatever. But she was telling me, I was asking her because there was a woman there. It was like a woman that my dad and uncle, or not my uncle, my cousin. My cousin's like a 50-year-old man. That's why everyone's so old. That they had grown up with. And she had come back to try and adopt this little girl and take her to America. Because this lady, she'd been married, but she had no kids and she was divorced. And she had all this, you know, she saved up her money and did well in her life and wanted to put her money towards trying to help this young Kurdish girl. And in the end, the Iranian government wouldn't let her adopt her and take her out of the country. But when I was speaking to her, you know, I was like, you know, are you in school? And she's like, why would I be in school? Like, I stay home and I work with my family. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, do you want to go to America? And she's like, yeah, you know, it'd be nice. I'll miss my family, you know, but like, you know, like whatever. And I was like, well, what do you want? She's like, well, you know, like, I mean, I just, you know, like she didn't really have any goals because she was, and then she goes, well, you know, in 2 years, when I turn around 14, I'll be married off into a different family and I'll work for that family. And I was like, you're going to get married off? And she's like, yeah. Like there was nothing, like she was so like, yeah, that's how it goes. I am the daughter of a Kurdish family that works for another family. Like I don't have a future like you do. Like I can leave, go back to America, go to college, whatever. I mean, I was an adult at that point. Like you can go to your job, you can live your life, you can fucking smoke your weed and drink your alcohol. Like I don't, that's not a life that girl will ever know. And there was something so heartbreaking to be like, fuck, like we have to get you out of here. And the unfortunate thing, that was about 2 years ago and I don't know where she is. should ask my cousin, but part of me feels like he's not going to tell me the truth. I don't know why. It just feels like it's so heartbreaking because I know they couldn't get her out. I know the Iranian government blocked the ability for that girl to get out of Iran and get adopted by this woman who would have brought her to America and potentially just given her a life. And that's who the Kurds are.
Yeah.
They are people who do not have a place to go. Now that they've created one, we're taking it away from them.
It's so disgusting that even within a country of other people, we're still able to find people to discriminate against because, I don't know, it just makes me really upset. Okay,
we're gonna take a quick break.
Yeah, we're gonna take a break and then we'll be back with Robert Evans from Behind the Bastards and other things. He's very learned and has a lot to say, so don't go anywhere. And we're back. Okay, ready to call Robert?
Yes, we're going to be joined with Robert Evans. He is the host of Behind the Bastards. He's the host of It Could Happen Here. He is the co-host of Worst Year Ever. This guy is out here. He's one of our great correspondents who goes out to the Middle East and does the work and does the journalism and writes about the truth. And he's going to have a podcast coming out about his trip to Syria. So I believe he's calling in. Robert Evans.
Robert.
Hey, how's it going, Anna?
Hey, Shireen's here too.
I'm here too, Robert.
Hello, Shireen.
Hi.
How are you doing there too as well also?
I am swell. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. We wanted to kind of...
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
there is no way you've listened to this show.
No, there's really no way. but honestly...
That's unfair.
Honestly, if we were to have anybody on that has knowledge about the Middle East, despite being a white man, it would be you.
Well, that's very sweet. I know enough to know that I don't know very much. Like, that's kind of the first thing that became really obvious to me when I started going over there is that, like, I would never understand a lot of what was going on over there just because everything's so complicated in every one of the conflicts I've reported on over there.
Well, that's the first step in becoming one of us.
Yeah.
Admitting you have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you were to come on, be like, yeah, I know everything. Let me break it down for you. You would be very unreliable and honestly awful to talk to. So thank you for being real. You were just in Syria. A month ago? Was it a month or 2 months?
Mid-August.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're calling specifically because we're talking about what's happening there as of late and America's recent declarations about pulling out and everything. But we want to talk about your experience in Syria and what you personally witnessed when you were over there and what your feelings are about this conflict because you were there so recently.
Yeah, you know, I'm heartbroken right now. The place I was is a region of northeast Syria that's sometimes called the northeastern, like, autonomous region. Rojava is the most common sort of colloquial name for the area, which just means west in Sirani Kurdish, but that's sort of the name that has been applied to the area. And it's, I think, kind of inaccurately referred to by the media as the Kurds. That was initially true when 2013, when the civil war was new and when ISIS was expanding. It was mostly Kurds fighting in that region against ISIS and against the regime at that point. And kind of the core of that resistance movement, the bulk of it in the early stages, were members of the PKK, which is recognized by the U.S. and by Turkey, but not by most other countries, as a terrorist organization. They would call themselves, they're more like, they've definitely committed some things that you could very fairly call terrorism. They're more in the vein of the IRA than, you know, something like ISIS. So, like, they have a purpose. Their goal is, like, Kurdish liberation. And they've gotten a lot better over the last 20 years in particular, as their leader, a guy named Abdullah Öcalan, who's been in prison for most of the last 20 years, has changed a lot of his views on things. And so they were the folks, sort of the most competent military force on the ground in northeast Syria when the government pulled out. And then they broadened out and started forming these other militias called the YPG and the YPJ. The YPJ is all female. The YPG is gender mixed. And then, you know, as they took more and more land, started, like, figuring out how to administer this area. And they're, you know, that Öcalan, the found, like, their leader, had all these different political theories about, like, a bottom-up sort of communal government based upon sort of, like being fundamentally non-hierarchical and non-authoritarian. And they're like, well, we've got all this land and there's 3 million people living here. I guess we should try some of this stuff out. And kind of like the central idea that Öcalan came to during his years in captivity, because he started studying a lot of like history and particularly like ancient prehistory, like about like sort of Neolithic peoples. And he came to the conclusion that the root of all of the Arab world's problems with authoritarianism and the root of all of the global problems of authoritarianism, fascism and all this stuff, the root of it all was the subjugation of women by men. And so that was one of the things he like reformed the PKK around, as being like a radical liberatory force for women. And so that's kind of the center of what's going on in Rojava. The center of what they call the Rojavan Revolution is elevating women and sort of freeing them from a lot of these bonds of what are essentially slavery in a lot of these communities. You know, Syria, if you were in like Damascus, you know, one of the cities before the war, you had a lot more options, obviously. But out, you know, in northeast Syria and a lot of these very traditional little villages, you know, there was very little in the way of freedom. And so a lot of the women that I met when I was in Rojava, these young women were like, yeah, when I was a kid, I just assumed that I was going to get married off when I was 16 or 17. You know, that would be it. And like, I wouldn't have any options. And then the regime left and this thing started up, this revolution started. And one of the first things that the PYD, which is sort of the political party that initially kind of started a lot of the stuff in Rojava, they built these things called women's houses in all the different villages and cities where women can come and say, if like my husband's beating the shit out of me, I want to get out. And they'll be like, okay, well, we'll find a place for you here. Or like you could say, I don't know how to, like, I want to have a career. I want to do something. I don't know what I want to do. They'll give you, like, job testing, and they'll find training for you and, like, help you find something to do outside the home. And we met a lot of, you know, one of the places we hung out when we were there was a really delicious Syrian food restaurant that was run by a collective of 12 women who had gotten funding from one of these women's houses to start a restaurant that was very successful. Another place we went was an all-women's farming commune. It was 25 acres and 6 big hoop houses. I think it was probably about the equivalent of maybe a 40-acre farm, producing a really significant volume of food. And it was all run by young women. And, you know, a number of them had stories of, like, they had to essentially get disowned by their families because, like, once the new, you know, once they were told what their options were, they were like, well, I want to make something in my life. I want to go do something outside of my family. I want to, like, try and build something. And their families were like, well, you know, not under our roof. And so the PYD found a place for them to live and training for them. And they, you know, were able to do something, but it meant leaving their family behind. So it's very complicated. And there's a lot of, you know, legitimate criticisms about Rojava and about the sort of the autonomous region there and how things work. One area where I think they really are beyond criticism is in the radical transformation of women's rights in the area. And it's immediately obvious as soon as you cross in from northern Iraq to northern Syria. The northern Iraq is considered to be definitely the best part of Iraq, you know, in terms of women's rights, the Kurdish governed region of the country. But you don't see women manning checkpoints. You don't see women holding guns. You don't see women giving orders to men. That's not something I've ever witnessed in all of my time in Iraqi Kurdistan. Mm-hmm. That changes as soon as you cross the border into Rojava. There are women running the immigration system. There's women at the checkpoints holding guns, working right next to men. There's women searching cars. There's women. It was the kind of thing I would just see out of the corner of my eye at times, like women and men going over maps and like conferring and like working. And I went around and I asked a lot of people how they felt about this. Particularly, I wanted to know how like older men felt about this. And I got a range of answers. A lot of them were very unhappy with this. And there were a lot of people who would say that they felt like women were oppressing them now. It was particularly common among the older men. When I at one point was hanging out in a room with 7 young people. I had any of them older than 22. They were afaish, which is the Kurdish word for police, basically, or military police, you would say. So I'm in this room with 6 or 7 of them. I think it was 5 men and 2 young women. One of whom was wearing a headscarf, and one of whom was not. So there's, you know, there were, you know, women who wore burqas, women who did not. Both of those things were allowed. It's certainly not like it's definitely not, you know, nearly as much religion there, but it's not like it's forbidden or anything.
Right.
But so we're sitting with these people and like talking with these kids, and I asked them the same question I've been asking everybody else, like, how do you feel about the changes to like women's rights and the fact that like women and men are working alongside each other? And all these kids just started like giggling awkwardly, and I was suddenly struck by the realization that like this was the same response I'd have gotten if I'd like walked into a Pete's Coffee and like asked the mixed gender workforce, how do you feel about women being able to do stuff? Like, it was just like they thought it was silly. It was normal to them. This has been going on, you know, since they were in their early teens. So like, there's a lot of, and a lot of the women I talked to were like, a ton of the men who will say the right things about like feminism and stuff when you interview them are lying. And, you know, if things, if the regime was back in control or if ISIS took over, like they'd be happy being shit to us. And, you know, one of the things my, my fixer Chabad, who, is a really cool lady, said is a big part of it's just sort of inertia. Right now, the misogynists feel like the weight of the culture is against them, so they're going to stay quiet and not make waves because they're fundamentally cowards. And as long as we keep them feeling that way, you know, if we could keep this going for another 10 or 15 years, it'll just be normal for the young people who will then be adults. And then, like, you won't have these people sort of lying in wait for the system to fall. And that's one of the things that scares me most about the fact that it all might go away is I don't know, you know, I desperately want to see what that place, what that region would be like with another 10, 15 years to make those changes stick. It's really an intoxicating place to be. The kind of the optimism that I felt and like the sense of possibility. Chabad, my fixer, the 29 years old, an anarchist like me, which was nice to encounter, a really gifted, very talented journalist, one of the best journalists I've ever worked with. She had lived with her family most of her life because that's very, you know, obviously very normal there. And she is the only woman she knows in her city, Kamishlo, who lives alone in her own apartment. That's a young woman.
Wow.
And she did that because she realized she didn't know any other young women who lived on their own. And she was like, I didn't really think that it would be realistic for like women to be soldiers until I saw women doing that. So I felt that if I get a place of my own, then other women will see me doing that and realize, oh, this is a thing that can happen too. So you saw a lot of stuff like that that does give me hope. When I was in Raqqa, former capital of the Islamic State, we went on patrol with an Asaif unit, and we were with the 17-year-old, one of the women in the unit was a 17-year-old lady, and she was just like, you know, stopping cars and searching them and making people like give her their papers, these guys who like were kind of suspected of being ISIS sleeper cell dudes. And I could watch little girls on the street looking at this young woman telling these men what to do and them obeying her. And like watching them watch that, that's one of those other things where it's like, I guess there's a part of me that thinks even if it does get smashed by the Turkish military, there's some seeds that have been planted that aren't easily going to be erased. So I'm not hopeless. I'm still holding out hope that something will happen. The international community will get its shit together to stop what's probably about to happen, which is wholesale slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like some of the stories coming out. I'm in touch with some of my friends up there. Some of the stuff that's happening right now is like large groups of older women and men are massing around the areas of the border where like the Turks are expected to attack, to essentially act as like bullet sponges, like fallen. And this is something
like,
I talked to a lot of older women about this, about like, you know, these women who had like joined up with like local councils and were like taking on like roles in local government for the first time in their lives. And I asked them like, what would happen if Turkey invaded or if Assad invaded? And they were like, well, you know, we'll die before we give up the stuff that we've like the freedoms that we've gained.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the other deep worries for me is that there's certainly members of the military leadership within the SDF, which is sort of the umbrella organization of all the militias in Rojava, that are willing to, you know, they have kind of a detente with the Assad regime. Assad doesn't move in to Rojava, and in return, they've been sending him oil and stuff. And it's something they've been very fairly criticized for, particularly by people who, you know, were very much on board with the FSA, you know, during the early days of the Syrian civil war.
Yeah.
Which I certainly was. And it's a legitimate criticism. I think that they called their shot at a certain point. They did initially start fighting against the Assad regime, and then they sort of made peace with him when it became clear that the international community was not going to really support the rebellion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a morally complicated decision. The people I met there, I didn't meet anyone who had anything nice to say about the Assad regime.
Right.
I can say that for sure. But they also, you know, Turkey is also an enemy of the Assad regime. And I think there's a belief among a lot of folks there that, like, if we have to pick one or the other, better to go with Assad than Erdogan. And, right. you know, they're both terrible. But you also have, you know, the Ba'athist regime in Syria, for all of its many, 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 many crimes, does not have a history of genocide against the Kurdish people, and the Turkish regime does, mm-hmm. which, you know, on balance, Assad's killed a hell of a lot more people than Erdogan, but there's a lot of folks in the leadership in Rojava, which is still, it's a lot less Kurdish dominated than it used to be, but it's still heavily Kurdish, who are going to trust Assad more than they would trust the control of Turkey. And that's not unfair. You know, one of the stories you'll hear a lot up there, I didn't just hear from people who lived there. I know a lot of journalists who were there in the early days of the civil war, where, like, fighters would cross in from Turkey with the approval of the Turkish government. And then when they were wounded, would cross back in and be treated in Turkish hospitals and then come right back out to fight.
Right.
And it was very much aided and abetted by the Turkish government. Because again, like, been enemies of the Assad regime for a long time. I don't know. That's my, I guess, rant. Is there anything else I should say?
Yeah, well, we have a few questions for you. So what was your very initial thoughts when you heard that Trump had backed a Turkish military operation to go in and fuck with the Kurds?
I thought about that very old, very famous phrase about the Kurds. We have no friends but the mountains, which has proven to be historically true, because they have a very long history of being betrayed.
Right.
And it was one of those things when I was there, I talked a lot with people about what they thought was going to happen in the future. They thought it's impossible not to think about a Turkish invasion when you're there. There were times when I was 20 feet from the Turkish border and this gigantic wall that's like, it's definitely the wall Trump dreams about building on the Mexican border, mm-hmm. that like scale of edifice. And you could see these guard towers looking down, and you could see hundreds of miles of tunnel being dug all across Rojava, 24 meters down by the SDF to, like, you know, allow for troop movements and like weapons caches when so like this was the kind of thing everybody was bracing for when I was there. And everyone sort of took it as given that the United States was going to abandon them. I don't think I met anybody other than one very adorably kind of naive YPG Special Forces guy who had been trained by the U.S. Marine Special Forces and was like very pro-American, but I think just because he really liked the guys who trained him, he was certain that he was not going to get abandoned. But pretty much everybody else was like, yeah, your government's going to leave us in the wind. And, you know, it was the kind of thing where I couldn't lie to him. Like, I had to say, like, yeah, I think we probably are going to abandon you. I get that feeling. So it's a bummer. I got really wasted a couple of nights in a row after that happened, because I'm bummed about it, but I'm not surprised.
I'm glad you brought up how morally complicated it is, because I was on an episode of Behind the Bastards, which you host, by the way, my mom called in before you left to go to Rojava, and she, as a Syrian woman, had her own reservations about the population over there, because in her mind, someone that was so pro the rebellion and against Assad, she almost thought of them as, not like, I mean, traitors is a very lofty word, but like, she felt betrayed by them in a way. And I think a lot of Syrians felt that way. And so it's definitely morally questionable, because you have to think about their interest as well. But it's so convoluted at this point. And there's this question about, like, are the Syria's deputy foreign minister, Faisal Maqdad, he is calling on the Kurds to, like, reconcile with the government at this point because it's this idea of, like, we're better together against the Turkish forces than we are separately. But in a way, I almost feel like the Kurds, like, even the phrase about the only ally or, like, our only friend is the mountain. I feel like they've isolated themselves. Not just, I mean, even in that phrase, yeah. I feel like they've isolated themselves from other Syrians. They've isolated themselves from Turkey. Like, at this point, like, it just feels so...
Well, they're a minority. They're not... They've also been basically most of their life ethnically cleansed.
Yeah.
They're trying to wipe them out.
Yeah, and I should also add that, like, what's going on in Rojava is very much like an alliance of minorities. We saw the different groups, we saw manning checkpoints and military bases. We saw Armenian units, Coptic Christian units, Arab units, Kurdish units, Yazidi units. There's a pretty wide, that's one of the things that's going on there. I think you're right about them isolating themselves. And this is my Iraqi fixer, the guy who got us into Syria, who I worked with a lot in Mosul. Rojava is the place he always goes during Ramadan because you can always buy a drink in Rojava. Like, it's not as religious as it is in Iraq. He does. So it's like, yeah. he likes it for that. But he was like, oh yeah, they're fucked. I mean, and it's because they're not flexible. They actually believe the ideological things they say, the stuff that Öcalan wrote, the kind of like, quasi-anarchist socialist philosophy, like they believe all that stuff, and so they were not willing to compromise on a lot of it, and as a result they have become very isolated. They just had the United States and our allies backing them, and that's a bad person to be reliant on. Mm-hmm. None of the local powers, even like in northern Iraq, the people, the Kurds of northern Iraq, like the actual, like most of the people you meet are fairly sympathetic towards Rojava, but the government of Iraqi Kurdistan, which is a terrible government as well, it's better than the government in Baghdad, but that's a low bar. They do not like what's going on in Rojava, and part of the reason is that what's going on in Rojava is kind of a fundamentally egalitarian movement. You see almost no wealth disparity over there. And in northern Iraq, you see enormous, like the many, many children and cousins of the Barzanis and the Talibanis, the ruling family there, like they drive brand new cars and live in condos that could be in like downtown San Francisco or whatever. Like they've gotten isolated in some ways because of their idealism, and in other ways they're very pragmatic, which is why they made the call to not fight the Assad regime after a certain point, mm-hmm. which also might wind up being kind of the end of the actual revolutionary experiment. Because if they get rolled back up into the Assad regime, it might save lives in the long run. Because if they're on their own against Turkey, it's going to be a massacre.
Yeah. So do you think they're going to end up allying with the Syrian government?
I don't know. I know there's been some movement there. I also know that a lot of Again, a lot of the people within the YPG, the YPJ, are believers. Mm-hmm. And if working with the government means giving up their autonomy, I think a lot of them would not be down for that.
Yeah.
A number of them would. It's not a uniform block over there. But, man, a lot of people would have serious trouble squaring themselves with that. A lot of the folks I've met, for certain.
I encourage everyone to listen to the episode that my mom called in on, because I think because even though the villages and the outskirts of the cities in Syria are kind of more, I don't know, like backwards in their thinking, like liberal Syrians, like my mom and her family, like she went to college, she lived on her own, she had an education, she had a job. I think there's a huge legion of like liberal progressive rebels that wanted to overthrow the government that in my mind would have been a perfect collaborators with the people that are progressive in Rojava.
Oh, yeah.
So it feels so sad to me that there's still this, that they're not united. Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. I mean, they did fight together very early on, but one of the problems is that this is something that very frustrates me when you talk to American leftists and they'll talk about how irresponsible it was of Obama to, like, give weapons to the rebels. And it was like, we fucking gave them nothing.
Yeah.
Like, I have a friend who's a journalist from Cyprus who's been over there like 30-something times. One of the guys who has covered, one of the foreigners who's covered the Syrian civil war from the beginning throughout the entire history of it. And he knew a lot of the guys in the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, back when it was really made up primarily of defected Syrian Arab army officers who weren't willing to, like, murder civilians and stuff. And, you know, he embedded with this guy's unit several times, and it was this dude he knew lost all four of his sons in combat against the regime and was sending his men into battle with 6-10 bullets each in a lot of these firefights because they just had no supplies. They were getting so little from the U.S. government. And this dude, who was, he considered a friend, wound up joining ISIS, not because he was a hardline Islamist, but because they had the bullets, because they had tanks. And that's the decision he made after losing all of his sons in battle. He was like, look, these guys have bullets and I want to kill regime soldiers. So I'm going to work with them.
Yeah. And that's how I feel like a lot of extremists start. They're desperate for survival and they just go with the people that will help them. That's the biggest gripe that a lot of Syrians have about Obama and about that whole thing is like, he didn't help us enough.
No, Obama did nothing.
No, he didn't help us at all. That, I mean, like, as much as we love his charisma and all that bullshit, he kind of was a coward.
No, he absolutely, there is nothing else Obama fucked up in his administration that compares to his failure in the Syrian civil war. It's a crime of historical proportion.
I would 1,000% agree, and I know every Syrian I know would agree with that. But I think, like, it's funny because people are, like, asking, they're like, tweeting at me or, like, messaging me being like, I'm sorry about what's happening in Syria, because I'm like, I'm sure I'm, like, the one person they know that's from Syria. But I'm conflicted because I admire the people in Rojava and this very feminist alliance they have, but I don't want them to ally with the government, but I also don't want them to get to have no other option. So it's like, do you in your mind, of having been there, having talked to them, is there a solution that you think would be plausible, or is it really just like time will tell?
I mean, the easiest solution would be a maintenance of the previous status quo, where we kept 200 soldiers stationed there and a promise that, and basically said, Turkey, you can't enter this airspace, which we were doing and which worked. And it costs us very little. The actual cost of keeping Rojava safe, of maintaining that airspace, it's a rounding error in the U.S. defense budget. You could continue to keep those people protected for a decade off of the cost of a single F-22. It doesn't need to take much. We're not talking, when we talk about like maintaining U.S. support to those people, I'm not talking about anything that's even really significant. Like it's again, like a couple dozen special forces guys and a no-fly zone. It's minimal. We lost, I think it was $6 billion in cash in the Iraq war. Not like lost as in we spent it on bullshit, but like we physically misplaced $6 billion in cash because people fucked up.
That's absurd.
And like you could maintain the no-fly zone over Rojava and a minimal special forces presence there for years and years and years and years and years and years and never equal the amount of money that we just misplaced in Iraq. Like it's, the idea that it's expensive or unsustainable for us to, like, that's one of the reasons is that, like, you look at a lot of U.S. foreign policy and it's just a complete clusterfuck, and it really is, and an expensive clusterfuck, like the war in Afghanistan and stuff. And it's almost shocking how competent our, especially in the last 4 years, policies in just northern Syria have been. And that's, you know, does not discount the fuck-ups in the rest of Syria. But, like, what we've done with supporting Rojava has been really successful and has ensured that about 3 million people have not had to endure the kind of violence and privation that they might otherwise have had to deal with. It's a bummer to me that that might all go away.
Yeah. I have two last questions. One, I was curious how much you heard from the people in Rojava about like ISIS working with Turkey or Turkey working with ISIS and helping them. Were people discussing that at all? Yeah, they were.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were people. I've talked to more people than I can count. And, you know, there's video and pictures of this, too, who watched ISIS fighters roll up in buses to the Turkish border, Turkish military buses, get out of the buses and cross into Syria. And likewise, wounded guys cross back into Turkey and go into hospitals. I talked to people who were in airports in Istanbul when foreign fighters were coming. It was very clear who they were, and it was very clear that they were being assisted in getting to where they wanted to go. Jeez. It is very obvious.
Yeah. So do you believe this is like Turkey's plan to just kind of ethnically cleanse that area and just get rid of all those people in Rojava and take it over for their safe zone plan or whatever it is?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they've done to Afrin. They took a region of Rojava already. The U.S. declined to defend it when they moved into the city of Afrin and the surrounding areas. And, you know, there has been, like, satellite analysis has shown that, among other things, they bulldozed all of the Kurdish cemeteries.
Wow.
And, like, their monuments to their martyrs and stuff, to the soldiers who died fighting ISIS. And they kicked out Kurdish families, and they took their homes, took their businesses, executed an awful lot of people. So, yeah, I think that's a reasonable fear. That certainly was what everyone was kind of expecting, was an ethnic cleansing. Yeah.
I mean, that's everything you described is like ethnic cleansing 101. Like, it's like, are you shitting me? Like, oh my God, that's disgusting.
Wow. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. You provide a lot of really great insight.
Yeah. And I know you have a plethora of information, and maybe you can join us again in a future episode to talk about your other experiences or just this one in particular as well. I really appreciate your time, and thanks for the work you do, man. It's good. It's good work.
Yeah. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on. I hope things get better.
I can't even say that without feeling so just like that's a sad thing to I hope so too, but like at this point, like, what does that even mean? I don't know. But I do encourage everyone to listen to, has any of the audio or anything that you recorded, has that come out on Behind the Bastards, or how are you releasing that?
It hasn't come out yet. It's going to be its own series.
Well, I recommend everyone staying tuned and waiting for that to come out. And maybe until then, listen to the episode where my mom called in, just because you guys love my mom. So what episode was that? Can we plug it in?
Oh, it hasn't come out yet. That's going to be part of the series on Syria.
Never mind.
When I get it finished. Yeah, I'm still in the process of getting it translated.
Oh, yeah. Well, until then, we'll try to keep you informed as best we can. Thank you again, Robert, for joining us.
Yes, and go enjoy your vacation now.
You're on vacation?
Yeah, I will.
He's about to
I
be.
Will at some point. theoretically.
Well, I hope after this call you can relax a little bit. I know we've just mentally and emotionally stressed you out. But yeah, thanks again. Thanks, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.
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 Wow. Robert always blows my mind because he really does have just like so much knowledge. Yeah. And I really do commend him as his work as a journalist and like really going to these places and being brave. And like, I do think like he has a bunch of privilege as a, I don't know, intimidating looking white guy. Like he's like a lot of tactical
gear.
Yeah. And I think he uses that privilege to his best ability because he tries to get information about things that are going on in the world.
Yeah, you know? And his work is very important. And you're right, he does have that privilege, but he also does the work and makes the effort, which I think is very, it's huge. It's very important. So yes, thank you again to Robert for talking to us and giving us insight into what it's like in that Rojava region with, you know, the Kurdish and other minority groups that are there, soon to be fighting for their lives. Who knows?
I mean,
unclear at this point what's going to go down. I'm sure more will have gone down by the time you guys hear this. And then, you know, like think of those people because they are going to potentially face the hardest battle of their lives against these fucking Turkish NATO militia Erdogan soldiers.
And we'll try our best to keep you guys informed on this because as far as the media is concerned, it's showing one side of the story. And I don't think it's really painting the picture in a complete way, whether it's about, I don't know, talking about the Kurdish population as like more than just the Kurds. There is so many people living in that region at this point that have all gone there for a reason to try to better themselves. And Yeah, we'll try our best to keep you informed. Maybe we'll get Robert back on the line eventually, because even though I'm Syrian and I've been there more times than I can count, I haven't been back since 2011, and he was there in August, and I've never been to Rojava. So I think he has a lot of information that I'd love to share with you guys, because it's worth talking to someone that was on the ground and someone that talked to the actual civilians there that have lived that life for as long as they can remember.
Yeah.
So
follow Robert at I Write OK on Twitter to follow his work. And again, you can listen to his podcast, Behind the Bastard.
Yeah.
It Could Happen Here and Worst Year Ever on iHeartRadio.
Yeah.
And wherever you get your shows.
Yeah, Anna and I have both guested on Behind the Bastards, if you guys want to listen to that. And I'm really excited for he's working on releasing what he recorded in Rojava as another project, and I'm really looking forward to hearing all of that, all the audio and all the stuff. My mom calls in at one point to talk about it, so stay tuned for that and follow him to keep updated. But until then, make sure you follow us at EthnicallyAmb, A-M-B on Twitter, and EthnicallyAmbig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. Follow me at ShiroHero on Instagram and ShiroHero666 on Twitter.
Follow me at Anna Hosni on Twitter. I hope this has been an informative episode for you. I don't know. We just felt it was needed because this is hell.
It's also kind of hard because, like, I don't fault these people, but I think I'm for the most part, the one Syrian that people know or know of. And I've been getting a lot of comments being like, I'm so sorry about what's happening over there. And I mean, I feel like I've gotten those comments ever since like a decade ago, which is fine. I actually don't know how to respond anymore. I'm like, yeah, thanks for your concern. But I'm glad that people are at least staying informed. And I'm glad that people know that this is a bad thing. But yeah, until next time. We will
You're
see
You're going to bite that ass?
Oh, we're going to be at fucking Chicago when you guys see that.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the Chicago Podcast Festival, October 16th.
On Wednesday.
It's in 2 days.
Yeah.
You still can buy your tickets. There's a discount link. You can get your tickets for cheaper because y'all assholes are not coming fast enough. So we had to get a discounted ticket link. So, yeah, come see the show. It's a one in a lifetime opportunity
to see us in person.
The Hungry Brain in Chicago.
The Hungry Brain in Chicago. Please, 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 if you're in the area in Chicago or the surrounding area or whatever, and you have any inclination to see us in person or support the show, it would mean the world to us for you to be there. So scroll down wherever you're listening to this, go to the footnotes, or if you're not listening to this on your fucking computer or phone or whatever, go to our Instagram or Twitter. The link is in our bio for the tickets. And yeah, just support the show, and we really hope to see you there in like 48 hours. So,
yes. So you're gonna bite that ass?
I will bite that ass.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.